magnetic wave in the photon and to interfere.
Okay, number one, there is no difference. They are simply two aspects of the same thing. One is behaves as a particle, the other behaves as a wave. Second, you got virtual particles all wrong. Photons and real photons, and you know, you could do photon counting. So photons are a thing. They're not virtual. There are virtual particles, supposedly. Now, if you go deeper down the rabbit hole, in quantum field theory, they're used as a method to get an answer. They're not measurable. There's no way of proving they exist. And there are techniques in quantum field theory that do not require or need virtual particles to give an answer. So many physicists believe that virtual particles are simply mathematical games that are played to make solutions to equations easier. But photons by themselves are not inherently virtual. There are very non-virtual photons out there, and they strike your retina every microsecond.
Kind of confused. Thank you very much for that. So let's go step by step. A virtual particle is a transient vacuum, quantum fluctuation that exhibits some of the characteristics of ordinary particle, and is having, or while it is having, the existence limited by the uncertainty particle. So the concept of virtual particles arises in perturbation theory of the quantum field theory. Do I have it right or wrong?
Well, once again, they are theoretical constructs. They are used in perturbation methods. There are other methods, quantum field theory, that do not use perturbation and do not use virtual particles. So again, there are many physicists out there that consider virtual particles to not be real things. They're certainly not measurable. They're not provable. They are, to those people, which I tend to believe it, simply a method to trick the answer out of difficult equations. But using things other than perturbation methods, which do exist, they are able to come to correct solutions without the requirement of utilizing concepts such as virtual particles.
Okay, the second thing. The virtual particles, they are described as a pair, a particle and anti-particle, which can be of any kind. So those pairs exist to a very short time, microseconds, milliseconds time, and then they mutually disappear and annihilate, right? Okay. But those pairs could be busted. Do I have this right? Interaction.
That's the theory that is used, but once again, no matter any technology you can imagine, experimenters have not demonstrated any proof that they do exist. The quantum field theory solutions for perturbation methods suggest that the method works in explaining things, but there is no experimental evidence that virtual particles ever exist. There's no one who's detected a virtual particle yet. So again, highly theoretical, not proven, and there are other ways of getting to proper quantum field solutions without utilizing them. So at this point, I tend to think that they're mathematical tricks. Unfortunately, that gets really esoteric, and I'm sure I'm boring some people out there with the very concept. And so people tend to use virtual particles all the time as a simple way of answering things. I mean, unfortunately, Stephen Hawking, who was a genius, and I seldom use the term genius. I think it's overused. He was a genius. Nevertheless, when he described the Hawking's radiation in his paper, he did not use the term virtual particle once. When he wrote his popular book for the popular, a weekend physicist, he made up this thing with virtual particles that tended to annoy physicists immensely. It was a much simpler way of explaining things, but probably totally incorrect, because it makes no real sense if you sit down and think about it.
So now I don't understand what I got wrong about virtual particles.
You seem to, let me see if I have it. Okay, you seem to, and if you read stuff from popular mechanics, you're not going to get the lowest level of the rabbit hole. You seem to think that they definitely are a thing that exists for a fraction of a second and then cease to exist, whereas it is my understanding that it is a mathematical tool and not part of reality as we know it. So you think the virtual particle comes into existence for X number of microseconds. I don't. That's the difference between the way we're both looking at this subject.
I was trying to avoid a concept of plane wave, but when you were talking about the waves and the photons, and you see no difference. Well, the photons aren't restricted to being represented by the Gaussian wave packet or really any type of the wave packet allowed by Maxwell equations. So a plane wave on one particular frequency is perfectly valid photon, probably except that it would occupy an infinite amount of space if we go to the plane wave theory. Actually, it's not a theory, it's actually a practice. Back to you.
Okay, let's go back. Theories are different things in science. General relativity is a theory. Now, you're not going to say that general relativity is a fact. You're going to say that general relativity is a theory. In science, a theory is a highly developed, well-researched, and not disproven a postulate. Postulates are more iffy than theories in science. And in normal English, unfortunately, the distinction is completely non-existent. Often you'll hear people say it's just a theory. But relativity is a theory. Quantum mechanics is a theory. It's not just a couple of guys, side of the envelope scribbling. It's real. It's there. So not quite sure about why something's a fact and something's a theory. And you can postulate all kinds of things. I'm just telling you about wave-particle duality, and photons are not the only things that have wave-particle duality. Electrons can, under certain circumstances, operate as a wave. You and I might think of it principally as a particle, but since there's no real such thing as pure particles or pure waves, if you shoot an electron at a double slit, it will show an interference pattern as well. Not only will it do that, but you can shoot single photons at a slit and have an interference pattern.
Yes, I do agree with that. I never questioned it. So, what is a plane wave? Interference.
I don't see why you're going to plane waves. They're kind of esoteric things. You yourself mentioned that they have to spread out to infinity. It's not used in quantum mechanics that I'm aware of. So, I mean, there's pilot waves, but pilot waves don't really explain wave-particle duality as well. And I don't know how pilot waves might be different aspects of planar waves. But, like I said before, not part of quantum mechanics as far as I'm concerned, not a solution to the problem as far as I'm aware. So I think it's a red herring, personally.
Thank you for that. I have a different opinion. In physics, a plane wave is a special case of wave or field, which would be the physical quantity whose value at any moment is constant through any plane that is perpendicular to the fixed direction in space. And it's used any time and every time. So if you have a damping wave, and then you have a sinusoidal wave, or you have a square wave of constant altitude, you have a traveling wave, you have a sinusoidal plane wave, you use the term of the plane wave just to describe the properties of that wave. So let's say you have a sinusoidal wave and you take the upper positive highest amplitude and then you drive the perpendicular plane across that. Now you can compare how the amplitudes varies or is exactly the same through each of every plane. And the distance between the planes is actually helping you with the wavelength of it. Thank you very much.
Okay, Wesley. All I can tell you is that much better minds than mine are trying to figure out wave-particle duality and quantum field theory. And I would assume if it was simple planar waves, one of them would have mentioned it, as opposed to no one that I've ever heard of. So you're free to have your theories and opinions. I haven't seen it discussed by anyone with a PhD in the subject, but I could be missing something.
Okay, so what happened when we have, when waves from two different or more sources exist at a given point in space? Entry.
It depends what the wave is. If the wave is a pressure wave, then you have interference. If the wave is an electromagnetic wave, since it doesn't have an inherent medium, it doesn't do anything until it either hits a solid object, a surface, or even a charged Coulombic field. It needs something else to kind of interact. Otherwise, it doesn't.
Yeah, we take longitudinal waves, then without any other means, we could zoom or destructively or constructively edge those two waves. Now, is it possible with electromagnetic waves?
Well, number one, electromagnetic waves are not longitudinal waves. They're transverse waves. They do not have a medium as opposed to longitudinal waves do. And they do not interact with each other unless there is something else interacting with them. Now, there is something theoretical, once again, called a Schwinger limit, in which at a high enough energy level, the vacuum of space-time is supposed to be nonlinear, and those photons can both interact with each other and can actually decay themselves into other particles. But once again, that is a theoretical construct. It has never been proven under any circumstances, and the best equipment presently available are orders of magnitude too low to get anywhere near the Schwinger limit.
For electromagnetic waves, let's assume that we have two electromagnetic waves. In the case of those two waves, the total of a wave at given point is the sum of those two waves. So the waves could add constructively in when they are in phase, or destructively when they are out of phase, or maybe something in between for other phases. At what circumstances for electromagnetic wave that would be true?
Again, and I think we're so deep into the weeds that we might have lost almost everyone, or made them indifferent. I don't know. But nevertheless, you have to have some kind of an interaction. It could be a particle interaction. It could be a charged particle's Coulomb field. But you need something. You can't just have electromagnetics interacting with each other in the vacuum of space.
Yeah, I gave that question because it is important for us as ham radio operators. If photon hits the matter, it deposits energy in form of heat. Okay, but we have resonant circuit, and then we have two waves coming there. We construct a circuit that could sum or divide or something in between of those two waves, right or wrong.
I'm a little confused of what question you're asking. Number one, when photons get absorbed, they don't necessarily are converted into thermal energy. They can. Photons are packets of energy, and energy can be transformed from one form to another. If it strikes a chlorophyll molecule, it is turned into potential chemical energy. If it turns, strikes a solar cell, it throws an electron out and produces a voltage potential. So photons don't necessarily only produce heat. They can, but they can form other forms of energy as well.
That is why I was asking what is the relation between electromagnetic wave and the photon, and that we actually came back through to the original questions there. But for us, if we have a mixer and we're mixing two frequencies, we can use it in our ham radio shot. But if we have a filter, we can filter those two different frequencies, so the only one is allowed. So yes, the wave could film, get deduct, and can be something in between. Enter here.
Okay, you lost me on the point of the exercise. Electromagnetic waves can be mixed together. They could be additive. They could, there are optical mixers in the same way that there are nonlinear electronic devices that operate at radio frequencies. They operate as mixers. You put in two different signals, and you get a sum and difference. There are nonlinear crystals that do the same thing. Sometimes they do photon doubling. In the case of a green laser pointer, there are crystals where infrared photons go through it. You could say electromagnetic waves, six of one, half a dozen the other, and the nonlinear crystalline material will mix a small percentage of those two lower energy photons and give you a higher photon energy. So there are optical mixers and splitters and things that are done on lower frequency radio waves. They require different techniques, but they ultimately accomplish very similar things.
And now we're going to the response of one of the ham radio operators about the crystals versus photons. Yes, he was right. There is one thing. I admit I was lazy when we were taught about the photons. I'm sorry, photons. Crystals. Yes, I was. But maybe Dr. Roy knows more. So I'm going to give you the quote. The challenge of making photons interact. At low optical powers, most optical materials exhibit only linear optical phenomena, such as refraction and absorption, which can be described by the complex index of refraction. However, a sufficiently intense light beam can modify a material index of refraction such that the light propagation becomes the power dependent. So we were talking that, the original statement of mine was that photon cannot interact with another photon. They don't see another photon. But of course, if we use nonlinear crystals, the miracle happens. Dr. Roy, maybe you can add more.
Well, I don't know. I'm a little confused because I thought I just mentioned all of that. In the same way that electronically, if you want to mix two signals, you have to put it into a nonlinear device. A linear device will not mix your signals and give you a sum and a difference. So in the same way that your mixer in your radio is inherently nonlinear, your optical crystal has to also have a nonlinear characteristic to allow the photons to interact with the crystal and produce a sum product type of situation. So these photons are not spontaneously interacting with each other in a vacuum. They are interacting in the medium of the nonlinear crystal.
Thank you for that. And the last thing that I have is just the information. There is a rig expert, AA600. The rig expert, is in production in Ukraine. So for some people who likes a good part of the equipment, you might not have a problem. You might not have a chance to buy it anytime soon. Dr. Roy.
Okay, I own a rig expert. I like my rig expert. They do not have a United States-based representative. As I mentioned, I think before, they have a representative who seems to live on the United States-Canada border. He lives in Canada, and he runs across the border and picks up stuff in a post office. So if you have broken stuff, he'll fix it under warranty. And so there's still a lot of services that can be performed, even though, you know, Ukraine is having problems. Although the business seems to be going on for many people. I have a lot of photographic software, and a surprising amount of it seems to be produced in Ukraine. And every so often they send me nice little emails telling me that they're still around, still producing. And if I would like some add-ons and to give them a couple of bucks for you know, just what's going on there, they're ready and willing to take it and give me products. So thankfully, there are parts of Ukraine that are still functioning. I do not know if Rig Expert is up to complete 100% of what it used to be. But they sell good products. Like I said, I own one, and if I didn't have it, I'd buy it again. So that's a good thing. They're also very, they have good GUIs, good user interfaces. They're very user-friendly. And the new models, I don't want to sound like I'm doing an advertisement, the Zoom variety is even better designed for user interface, with colorful displays, and it's a very pretty VNA. Usually you don't use the term pretty and VNA in the same sentence.
Those guys are from Kiev, so it's the capital of Ukraine. They employ 30 professionals in research and development, marketing, logistics, and department. Most of them are ham radio operators, and they really do great stuff, but also not only antenna analyzers, transceivers, some of the so what I know about not their situation, but situation they are, might be right now is that they might be now is the 4th of February in Kiev by Russian forces. They started the war, but was never conquered. Ukraine were able to throw them out, and now the Kiev is bringing life back, and thousands of people are coming back from Poland, Czechoslovakia, and other countries back to Kiev. Although still the situation is not safe, so maybe they would be able to renew the manufacturing. I didn't know about the Canada professionals that help with repairing the stuff. If you know more, please tell us.
Well, I pretty much told you what I know. I had a problem. Some power regulator chip blew out under warranty, and I needed to get it fixed. And they told me to send it to a P.O. box number upstate New York, close to the Canada United States border, and they told me that their technician who deals with these things kind of jumps across the border, picks up the stuff from the P.O. box, brings it home, fixes it, comes back and mails it in the United States, so that there's no duty problems, I guess. That's all that I kind of know, that he's located at the border, which I thought was rather interesting. Usually, United States, the representatives are located in the United States, but in this case, I guess they decided it was cheaper to have one guy work two countries. Maybe there's some company out there that works right down there at the Mexico-United States border and sort of does the same thing there. I don't know.
Okay, thank you. That is all for now what I have from you, for you guys, and maybe somebody else has other questions. Enter the GM.
Okay, very good, Wesley. Thank you for your participation. I hope I didn't bore too many people out there with quantum field theory and virtual particles and Hawking radiation and all kinds of fun stuff. Nevertheless, let's take a little breather. Hopefully there'll be still a few more people with a few more questions, but I think this would be a nice opportunity to try a little puzzle. Now, this puzzle might kind of blow up in about 3 seconds with the answer. A bunch of very clever people listen here, and so I'm sure that's a possibility, but we will give it a try. Let me drop for a second. Okay. So, I was thinking back to the good old days. The first transistor that was designed at, we mentioned Bell Labs, who gave us the decibel, but they also gave us the transistor. It was a germanium crystal. Properly doped. It's 1947, I believe. That, if you look on your periodic table, is called a group 14 element. It's the third element in the column that's group 14. If you look up for the second element in group 14, you'll surprisingly find silicon. Now, silicon has pretty much taken over primarily for semiconductor devices. This is among other things, because it's a lot cheaper than germanium, and they've discovered how to produce it and manufacture it and create it in all kinds of interesting ways. So it takes up approximately 99%+ of all semiconductors these days are made of silicon. But let's go back to the periodic table. Let's go back to group 14 and see what the first element in that column is. And it's carbon. Well, good old carbon. We're created from carbon. So my question tonight for people out there is, does anyone know of any semiconductor devices that are based on carbon? If so, what kind of devices do that? And if so, does anyone out there own any of those devices? So I open it up to the audience. Let's see how quickly they can blow this answer up. Okay, Ed, I'll take your maybe.
A phasing now with high power, high frequency power transistor on carbide. My guess is kind of a low alloy of silicon.
Interesting.
Yes, Wesley?
Before germanium, there was selenium. If you remember, maybe many of you remember, the old, very much smelly rectifiers in the power supplies. Selenium was employed. Enter a fear.
Yeah, I remember those. So, wow, I haven't thought of them.
Yes, indeed. Selenium was used as a rectifier, and you can pretty much tell if they went bad because they stunk like hell. I would still just consider that, and I might be just fudging things, silicon-based, but a silicon carbide. What I'm looking for is something that's primarily devoid of germanium and silicon and any other group 14 elements other than carbon.
A2SCP.
Yes, Chris.
Hi, Roy. This is a wild guess, but I thought I remember hearing resistors are carbon, but this is going back a ways.
Absolutely correct.
Well, I mean, carbon is not a good insulator. It's not a great conductor. It is used for resistors, carbon thin film and such. I would still consider it a semiconducting material. It's a little bit better than the silicon and the germanium. But that would be a resistor. A resistor isn't really a semiconductor device. It is just a resistive device.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Just gone back to the selenium. I believe that was poisonous. They found out that was bad news while we were handling it all these years. I believe they came up as a poisonous substance.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there's a lot of things that people touched and contaminated and are not healthy for you. Beryllium. I don't know if you're familiar with that element. Sometimes is used for the tweeters of a very, very expensive speaker system. Beryllium can be toxic as well. I think a French speaker company only about 5-10 years ago came out with a line of speakers that had beryllium tweeter domes. So yeah, there's a lot of noxious stuff out there. I mean, when I was in college, I was exposed to all kinds of benzene fumes, and we filed asbestos pads so that we could poke test tubes through them all the time, not under hoods, because we were ignorant. We were ignorant. We learned our lesson, hopefully. But yeah, selenium's not a great thing. There's more than a few reasons why it has gone the way of all things electronically. But once again, is there anything out there that's carbon-based semiconductors? And would you own one? Yeah, you might. You might not know it, but you might own one.
It works about better than you.
Okay, Ed, you can talk about beryllium, and then Wesley will talk after you.
Beryllium oxide is a ceramic that is used particularly as base for a lot of high-power transistors, but a very good heat conductor. A lot of transistor silicon chips are on a beryllium water to conduct the power metal case to be. The problem is if it's ground up into a powder and you inhale it, it is poison. That is something ham should factor in mind. Sorry for going off topic.
No problem, Ed. Like I said, I brought up beryllium, so I'm interested. Wesley, you want to say something about beryllium?
Yeah. Hold on. It's another field dealing with particle physics. There are plenty of things beryllium has application for. Let me jump. So it's a hard grade metal. Could you find in rocks, coal, soil, volcanic dust? So yes, it is absolutely harsh. It's absolutely dangerous. But not as a window or as one piece can do nothing for you. So it's not kind of contagious. The powder from it is yes, that's sure. But because it has a large scattering cross section for high energy neutrons, the beryllium window or the beryllium small plate is used as a neutron reflector and neutron moderator. But actually, it is slowing the neutrons to the thermal energy. But apart from that, if you have, I'm not going to say which isotope, but some isotopes, you can actually direct window from the beryllium, and then you have a neutron gun. And to exchange.
WS2N on beryllium?
Yes, Paul.
That whole frame of the James Webb Space Telescope is the whole support structure is beryllium. You know, they would take whole sections, one big piece, and just drill it out, keep drilling it out, and whatever it took to make one, each mirror was roughly meter, you know, so you have each mirror, so you have 18 beryllium fraggings. The whole thing is made out of that. The reason I used it was for, it has a great heat coefficient, you know, for shrinkage. It doesn't shrink or expand, you know, at low temperatures.
Yeah, it has a lot of interesting qualities. I think it's a very, very stiff metal, for its density. And that's why some tweeters were tapped with it. So, yeah, it's a very interesting material. It has a lot of interesting characteristics. And the minor fact that it could be terribly toxic, unfortunately, complicates things. Anyway, this is AC2GS, and we're back to our puzzle. I'm kind of happy that it's a little bit of a problem answering. I admire all you people. You're very smart. You're very clever. A lot of times I'll throw out a puzzle, and I'll see the answer pop up in the chat room simultaneously. But once again, let me point us away from beryllium for the time being and back on the subject at hand. A semiconductor that is based on carbon as opposed to silicon and germanium. What might that be, and do you own one? Because I'm sure there's some guy out there that owns one.
A question on a puzzle?
Yes, certainly.
Yeah, this is PDH. Does this device use doping of carbon in that holes and electron pairs are created in the carbon? Go ahead.
Well, it's unfortunately not that simple. These structures are not crystalline carbon. They're complex molecules that use carbon in the matrix that they produce. They do have p-n junctions, though.
AF2P with a guess.
Okay. AF, I shouldn't write it down. The first gentleman.
Called AF2P, Ed. And I'm thinking of a carbon arc lamp. I built carbon arcs. You put a high voltage in it, suddenly arc, and it becomes highly conductive at that high voltage.
Okay, and it certainly is an effective light-emitting device, but I wouldn't really call it a semiconducting device. It just arcs to the carbon electrode and eats out the carbon. So the carbon itself, as far as I'm aware, is pure carbon material. There's no other thing going on there. So although it does use carbon, I would not call it exactly a semiconducting device.
Are you talking about the CMOS transistors?
I'm unfamiliar with the term. Could you say it again?
CMOS, CMOS.
Complementary metal oxide semiconductor. No, that's all silicon.
Yeah, those are silicon-based. You could probably make them out of other things. I know field effects transistors are being made out of different types of crystal mixtures, but no, that wouldn't be the answer to this particular question.
Why was carbon used in some kind of tubes, you know, to control the electrons, like in the gate?
Well, that's a good question that unfortunately I'm not quite sure of. The way that, you know, there are some people that call vacuum tubes thermionic valves, in that they produce the heat produces when you heat up an object, some objects discharge electrons, and that goes through the grid and the plate and what have you. There might have been some carbon-based material as part of a vacuum tube. Again, it would not be my idea of a semiconducting device. It would just be some aspect of a vacuum tube to possibly modify some physical aspect of the design.
And to extend
carbon plates.
Yeah, you got cut off a little bit. You said something about a carbon plate. Are you alluding to a something that goes into a vacuum tube?
I believe some transmitting vacuum tubes had plates made out of carbon.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't kind of research all the aspects of vacuum tubes, but that's interesting. Was there any particular benefit to that design modification?
I believe heat dissipation.
Oh, okay. There are forms of carbon that have an incredible ability to dissipate heat. Graphene does, diamonds do. Diamonds dissipate heat like nobody's business. So I could certainly see. I don't know if cheaper forms of carbon would have quite the degree of temperature dissipation that the more expensive varieties do. But that's interesting.
And to exchange.
Yeah, Wesley, one second. There was another gentleman. Unfortunately, he doubled with Ed, so I couldn't write down his call sign. But the other guy who threw out his call sign, would he like to offer a guess or the answer?
Valley Stream, and I think you just mentioned it, graphene.
Okay, well, I don't think I'd give away the puzzle that easily. Graphene is still a very experimental substance. Getting any kind of high purity, large graphene structures are still incredibly expensive, if not almost impossible. There are a lot of people conning other people and selling them basically graphite as graphene. But no, I wouldn't quite call it functionally a semiconducting device. In practice, I mean, I'm sure there are guys out there who are going to try all kinds of interesting tricks with it or other somewhat two-dimensional molecules. I think molybdenum simulates some graphene-like qualities, but that's still in the research. That's all top-secret stuff that I am not able to access.
That's beyond it.
Okay, Wesley?
I'm going to give you my point of view, but actually you said it all. You said you're not going to give out the puzzle. Carbon does exhibit semiconductor property, but it will require a lot of energy to work. So the more an electron is near the nucleus, the stronger its covalent bond. Since the carbon has only two shells, the valence electrodes are pretty tightly bonded, while in case of silicon, we have the ideal three shells. So it's not that. But you said it all. It's a diamond. Diamond is a semiconductor with a very large band gap. And to exchange.
Well, I guess theoretically, on a research level, I am totally unaware that anyone is practically producing diamond-based semiconductors anywhere. Maybe the military, but again, it's above my pay grade and my my secret level, which is just a taxpayer. So, although there are probably some guy in some research lab puttering around trying to make these things work, I am looking for a much more ubiquitous example that many people already own. I doubt that you own any diamond semiconductor-based devices.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
I admit this is a long shot, but is the answer an electric microphone?
No. Are you thinking in terms of carbon granule microphones, old telephones? When I was a little kid, I took apart a telephone and discovered how the microphone worked by the carbon granules. Are you alluding to that?
I'm alluding to it, but my boots aren't high enough to wade into that water, so that was my best shot.
Okay, it's a good one. I tested this puzzle beforehand, and I got surprisingly most of the answers that everyone is offering me, but carbon microphones don't operate as semiconductors. They don't have PN junctions, and they predate semiconductors. So, carbon granule microphones probably were a thing before the turn of the 20th century. So, unfortunately, no, Jim. No cigar.
These values carbon microphones.
Well, yeah, I'm sure there's a place for them. You know, I don't know. Probably the technology is incredibly improved over the years. I found the old-style carbon granule microphones to be rather noisy, personally, but I'm sure the 21st century has re-engineered it into something much much more sophisticated.
How about a carbon-based battery, Roy, WS Flint?
Okay, carbon-based batteries have been a thing for a long, long time. There were some times where experiments recommended that you get an old battery and you break it open to get the carbon rods out of it. But again, the carbon is just part of an oxidation reduction chemical reaction that produces free electrons for voltage potentials and for currents. They don't have p-n junctions. They don't act as semiconductors.
AC to PM.
Yes, Jeff. Now we got a chemist.
We got two chemists if we include both of us. We did some work with buckyballs and carbon nanotubes a long time ago, and certain amount of doping with, you know, electron sources, you know, reductions with lithium gives them interesting properties. And I'm sure there are much better people that can talk about it. I know this is not what you're talking about, but those are the only other kind of conducting forms of carbon I could think of off the top of my head.
Okay. You know, I mean, carbon is a fascinating subject. You know, it's capable of all kinds of things. Wesley was discussing diamonds. Diamonds may end up being the substrate of future semiconductor chips because of its ability to dissipate heat. Buckyballs, nanotubes, all kinds of, you know, Buck Rogers in the 25th century. There's a lot of material science waiting to be finessed using a lot of these things that right now are incredibly cost prohibitive. But I tend to think, like most things, where there's a will, there's a way. There was a time, not in any of our ages, we were alive, where aluminum was more expensive than gold, because the ability to take bauxite and turn it into the metal aluminum was, no one had the faintest idea. And so it was very difficult to mine and refine aluminum. Until they discovered a cheap, easy way, and now we have aluminum foil. So who knows, maybe someday we'll have graphene foil. That would be something to look forward to. But nevertheless, I hope, Jeff, when I either give the answer or someone gets the answer, that he won't have a semantic argument with me on this subject. But I think you'll agree with me. We'll see.
I have a question to the chemist.
Okay, Wesley, you could ask Jeff a question.
Not good in chemistry. My father was. He was a teacher of chemistry, mathematics, and physics. Crystalline carbon. So, in example, diamond is a semiconductor at higher temperatures where the silicon would fail. A question, do we have any other crystallines of carbon you can mention? And to exist?
I guess it depends on what you mean by a crystal, but that's taking it out in the left field compared to what Roy's trying to do. So I'll send it back to Nat, and you and I can have a discussion offline.
Okay, very good. Let's bring it back on focus. I don't know what to tell you guys. I'm sure someone will figure it out very soon. So is there anyone else who would like to hazard a guess? You know, ultimately, if there's no guesses, I will give clues. But curious to know if someone won't kind of pull it right out of the air and present it to us all.
VDH, would you guess?
Yes, John.
Are there any carbon-based photovoltaic cells that are principle?
Well, not to my knowledge. There are all kinds of interesting technologies, the perovskites and other such things, but as far as I'm aware, they're not carbon-based.
Just a guess.
It's a good guess. I commend you. You know, you think it, which is the idea of the exercise, I hope, to get everyone's brain's synapses flowing.
It's USTP.
We have a tin, and we have... Yes, selenium was there. I'm thinking, what we didn't talk about?
Didn't talk about the answer yet. UTP?
Tin. We spoke about selenium. What else? We have diamond, silicon, germanium, tin, selenium. Hold on. Let me think. I think I can get it.
Okay, while you ponder it, Wesley, I think, I'm not sure, KC2, I heard a bit of a call sign?
Here goes me, Roy, K2STP. Just a question on it. Is this semiconductor used in ham radio?
Theoretically could be used in ham radio. It might be used in ham radio. Personally, I have not seen an example of it in ham radio devices.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
All right, I'll take another shot at this. Is there a carbon-based diode, or am I out in left field?
Okay, I will answer your question and also consider it a bit of a hint. We're talking about some kind of a diode, so hopefully that helps.
Rectifier comes to mind.
Well, I mean, that's just another term for a diode, but in this particular case, you would not use this technology as a rectifier.
So you're saying warm. Very good, thank you. I'll keep scratching my head. Over.
Tellurium is also semiconductor.
Okay, Wesley, but you're not actually answering the question. You're just giving me other elements that are not quite insulators and not quite conductors. And the question is related to carbon. By the way, John, who's in the chat room, KD2BD, asked, is it a pin diode? No, it is not a pin diode, John. But good guess.
KD2WOD.
Yes, Chris.
Yeah, you hear a lot of talk about carbon nanotubes.
Yes, carbon nanotubes are very interesting. I mentioned it a little bit earlier with Jeff, AC2PL. Nanotubes, buckyballs, graphene, different structures that use carbon atoms in interesting ways that give us a great deal of promise for material science in the future. But right now, all those things are pretty much in researchers' hands. To my knowledge, there's little to nothing that's legitimately being commercially manufactured, produced, and used. And this particular example is extremely manufactured, produced, and used.
You were talking about group number 14, right? So it's a carbon, silicon, germanium, lead, flavonium. What else did I forget? Antrexia.
Okay, it seems that you're going down a rabbit hole, Wesley. I'm pleased that you have a good memory of the periodic table. But again, the question at hand is, somewhere, someplace, there is a primarily carbon-based semiconducting material that is manufactured, produced, and a lot of people own them.
Well, lead is 82, but lead is not semiconductor. I'm going down to the rabbit hole.
WS2N.
Okay, Paul recognized, I think that was Jim. You kind of doubled with the tail end of Wesley, if I'm correct?
Correct.
Yes, what would you like to say?
I seem to remember a carbon pile. Does that get us any closer?
Well, no. Carbon piles exist. They slow down fast neutrons, you know, make them thermal neutrons. So there are carbon piles, but again, it's just carbon material. It's not used as a semiconductor. It's not used as an electronic device. It's purely a material that slows down neutrons in reactions.
Okay, WS2N, how about thermostats, the oldest thermostats you have?
Okay, I am unfamiliar with a carbon-based thermostat. It still probably wouldn't come to being a semiconductor. There are dissimilar metals that bend away and break contact of the electrical heating system. There are mercury level detecting devices. I don't recall ever seeing anything that had carbon. I'm curious, where was the carbon in the thermostat?
I know you're talking about the bimetal strips that move, but you know, there might be some type of thermostat where they're running current through it, and as the temperature changes, it becomes like a thermistor. You know, it changes the resistance, and then you know that would affect the thermostat, make the change, but maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. John in the chat room, KD2BD, also mentioned that you probably meant a thermistor. I wouldn't call a thermistor a semiconducting device. It is a temperature-sensitive resistor, so there would be no PN junctions per se. Once again, keep in mind I gave you a clue that it's in the form of a diode. So think in terms of what might be your possession that's a diode that's not a rectifier.
B2SDP.
Yes, Chris.
So I thought of this right away, and I don't know if it's really a semiconductor or not, but every keyboard has a carbon something or other to make it work. So just throw it out there, something to do with the keyboards.
Okay. You're talking about membrane keyboards, the bane of my existence. I like mechanical ones. What's going on with them is you have two usually printed circuit board contacts, and then the key pushes down a carbonized foam that acts as a conductor, and the electronic senses the making of contact, turns it into code for the computer, and the keyboard does its thing. Again, that's just a means of shorting two contacts together. It's not a diode. It's not a PN junction device.
Is it poisonous as arsenic?
I do not know if the material is toxic. In production product, it is safe. But you never know with materials. They might have some toxicity. I'm unaware.
I assume the crystals are not caught.
Say again, Ed. I couldn't make it out.
I assume that galena ore rectifiers are not carbon.
Yes, I would also think that they aren't carbon.
Oh, well.
Good try. All you guys have wonderful ideas, and I really appreciate that you played along with me, and I really do like that. KD2BD was asking about Schottky diodes that use carbon doping. Unfortunately, I am not familiar with that. I kind of thought Schottky diodes are your basic silicon-based devices. I'm not quite sure. They might have some kind of carbon in them. I do not know. I've read recently about Schottky diodes, but I don't recall them requiring carbon doping. So this might be a possible use for it. I don't know if the carbon doping itself has anything to do with PN junctions, or it's there for some thermal dissipation or something.
VDH with one guest.
Sure, John. Possible metal oxide barriers, sir. Now, I know they say metal oxide, but I was wondering if there are elements, a portion of that is carbon. But, well, as far as I'm aware, no, that's not what I'm looking for. Like I said, if you don't have one, I am sure someone you know or some relative has one, and it's probably something that they're somewhat proud of to one degree or another.
AC2PL.
Yes, Jeff.
Okay.